Blog Talk Radio.
What's up, everybody? It's that time again on the last day of the year. That time again. I'm sorry, I've got a little couple of different things going on here at the control center. I am Citizen Payne. This is the last day of the year on the Kay Thompson Live show. And, okay. Alrighty then. For sure, lady. Sorry, I was talking to some people on the little... I got a couple of different devices going on here. It's December 31st. You've reached the Blog Talk Radio. If you're listening to my voice, obviously you're on the Blog Talk Radio or the podcast or whatever. And this is the Kay Thompson Live Show. I'm the person that you know, usually, if you listen to, known as the son, Citizen Payne. Kay Thompson, my mother, is on assignment in heaven. And I'm down here and continuing the show, doing the things that we've been doing for so long. Talking about issues, talking about non-issues, personal stuff, you know, things that are part of the human experience. And this is, as I said, the last day of 2019. And if you check out the description, let me take it off the speaker. If you check out the description of the show, I put down one of the toughest in the life of the show, obviously, because it's the passing of my mom you know, how tough does that get? And as well as my sister last December and my cousin the March before that. I also lost another family relative recently, right before, after Christmas. So it's been a very rough year, you know, and it's like that people say often at this time of year, the holidays, I guess maybe in certain circumstances, I don't know, situation of my mom and my aunt, they were in their 80s. So, I mean, realistically, if I'm honest, that's a good life. And I was blessed to have them in my life for all of my life anyway. And fortunate that they had those long lives, productive lives that they did. As for, you know, my cousin and my sister, you know, sometimes we have those challenges in life. That's what it's about, I suppose. I've been learning these last years at this stage of life. You know, you see life differently at different stages, obviously. Well, hopefully you've learned some things and realizing, you know, that when you're a kid, your parents are preparing you for the world, obviously. But they're really preparing you for one day, to be on your own. Because what happens, children grow up, they become adults, they leave their parents' house, they have their own family, hopefully. You know, if they want, if that's what their desires are, and things work out for them. And and the cycle continues, you know, if they have children and so on. And what happens is, as the parent, you are training your children to be self-sufficient, to be on their own one day. Obviously, when you're not going to be around as a parent, of course, you don't realize that till later, you know, but that's what I've been realizing lately. As I've been seeing the older generation of my family, you know, dwindle. And like I said, it's a part of life. So, you know, you guys, everyone should understand that, and we all kind of grieve. You know, I've often said, or I've noticed recently, this is what I noticed upon the passing of my cousin, was that the great equalizer in life, the one place, one of the few places, perhaps, where people are all of one accord and put away all of the hatred and things that we throw in each other's way to come closer together as human beings is the ICU, intensive care unit. Just a great equalizer in that room because everybody has the same objective. If the person in the bed wants to get better, the person there seeing the person in the bed wants them to get it better. The people working in the ICU want them to get better. Everybody has one purpose, one accord. And no matter who it is, you know, strangers, people, if you've been in the ICU, I had the misfortune to have to be in an intensive care unit for a family member. You'll see there's many people in there, all of us praying, all of us hoping, you know, that we can have more time with our loved ones, and the staff and the medical professionals are trying to do the same thing, you know, save someone's life. And obviously people who don't want to die, I suppose, most of the time, but and they're hoping to live. So if somehow that type of energy can be channeled, the energy of all of us being on one accord, wanting the best, you know, I mean, you know, I've prayed for other people I've seen in the ICU that they would have the victory and their loved ones would get better as I prayed for mine. Because, you know, just imagine if we all had that same energy. We see that energy in mobs and crowds and sports events. We'd see that energy. And if it could be harnessed for good, then it becomes a good thing. When it's not done for good, obviously, we see what happens, that we type of behavior we've seen over the last several years. And, you know, brings us to, like, the year in review, right? The year in review with the current president, you know, current president. Yeah, he's three years in, I guess he's the president. You got to call Donald Trump number 45 president of the United States. And he has not proven to be one that is fit for the job. That's my personal opinion. A lot of people said that. But to be more objective, you know, he's not one that has done it traditionally as other presidents have performed the duties of the presidency of the United States. You know, politics, and that's when public service becomes politics, is the gray area that people use that's inherent within public trust, public office, public service, you know. That's public trust. The public is trusting you when they vote you into office to do the right thing for them, you know, and to achieve whatever goals and that they agree with you on. So that's public trust. And inherent in that, once obviously someone gives you their trust, inherent in that is the possibility that someone might betray that trust. And certainly when you have big issues, big events, big numbers, you know, things operating at a high level, I think the temptation to betray people's trust is greater for those that might have a tendency to go that way. Obviously, sometimes they say, and we've seen good people go bad, but, you know, if certain people believe certain things, that means deep down inside that was something that was okay with them, something that they condoned and wasn't really a sticking point for them. And maybe you guys know where I'm going with this. But I'm going to, like, how people can support someone like Donald Trump when, to me, he's exhibited racist views, a racist perspective, which is anti someone like me. Obviously, I'm a person of color. Clearly, racist people have all kinds of negative opinions and actions. So, you know, that's already said and done. We don't need to talk about that. But obviously, that's going to make me not support the guy. So, hearing that, there's no black and white for that. There's no gray area in that for me. There's no way that I could like some of the stuff he does and not some of the stuff. That's one of the red lines for me. And therein lies the gray area, because the morality issue of politics and of government and societies, there's a moral issue. And some people aren't moral, clearly, or some people's morals are not as strict as others, just to be kind to some people. And like I said, some people don't have any morals. So within that area, that gray area, people can abuse the public trust. People can hold up funding for a country that was sanctioned and okayed by a co-equal branch of the government. Congress is a co-equal. The president is not higher than the Congress. Congress is an equal branch of the government, right? So You know, there's no two ways about that. You know, if we're supposed to be a country that governs ourselves on laws and order, and you have laws written down, and then the individuals try to find ways to try to find ways. Sorry, there's a theme song for you. Individuals try to find ways to get around those laws and rewrite those laws, and there's always, you know, there's that gray area again, that loopholed area that immoral people can abuse should they see fit. That's why, you know, we have alternate set of facts. These people are referring to alternate set of facts, and I saw one Talking Head show where the gentleman was talking about how there's an alternate reality that Trump was able to create. You know, now with technology being what it is and Twitter and all these things to directly get your story out there, you know, and the guy was saying he's got more viewership and listenerships and eyeballs and ears than some small news websites and some small news stations. So and that, he's just got his own army and people are going to believe whatever he says. And in that, and then you have news organizations like these conservative organizations that clearly, well, at least in Fox's case and one or two others, they have no problem with lying or making up the facts. So they call it, you know, our facts, their facts. The people always, there's no base of standard, bottom standard of facts that everybody can agree upon and go from. And that's what they're calling it. Everybody's using different set of facts, this and that. And there's no such thing as a different set of facts. There's either the facts or not. The facts are no facts. It's not a different set of facts. You might have more facts. You might have facts to add to give fuller context to the whole story or issue. But don't fall for the thing when people say we have a different set of facts. No, you're just lying. You're lying. You're making stuff up and you're lying. You're making stuff up, calling it facts. And when you do that, you're lying. So there's no different set of facts. There's no operating, you know, people talk about we need to get a baseline of the facts that we're going to operate from. No, it's either facts or not. And this is my issue, as I've said many times to people, with the Democratic Party in terms of how they present their argument to the public. How you present the argument to the public to someone who lies consistently. And I think that instead of trying to expand the voter base to individuals who agree with certain immoral actions of the person that they support, why not we expand the voter base to people who haven't voted before because they've been turned off by the system, see what it is about the system, and see if we can reach them. Because trying to reach people who have gone and supported people who seem to be questionable from a moral perspective, not only from a different opposite party and belief ideology perspective, but also, you know, I think the red line in that kind of trying to reach out and appeal to people on the other side of the aisle, I think the red line for us to be drawn and trying to reach out to Republicans that used to vote with Democrats should be, you know, how moral. It should be the moral test, right? It should be a moral test because that's one of their talking points, the moral issue, the Christian issue, the religious issue, the doctrine. That's what they always – so let's get them on their own points that they make. You know, let's point out when they lie. Let's not let them get away with coining the phrase transcript when that wasn't a transcript that he released at the phone call. Let's call it what it was. It was a summary. It was you guys wrote it. It was like a book report. I've said before, you guys have heard me say that. So once we do that and reject their narrative of lies, of making stuff up, those little consistent lies that add up after a while and they get into the ether and the ozone and the Twitter sphere and the internet and they become facts because there's people who, A, want to believe it, is going to believe everything he's going to say anyway, and people who just, you know, they're not too well versed in news and what's going on. As we see, that's a lot of people are like that. But something that gets repeated, like they said, a lie repeated over and over enough will become like the truth to some people. So we have to, at every moment, at every juncture that these people lie, we have to call it out. We can't let any of it slide. And that's my issue a lot of times with the Democratic Party. We let too many things slide in terms of trying to be, I think intellectual and, you know, the moves and all that. Let's just straight call out the lies first off, correct the record. Also, we need to do a better job of educating the public in terms of what's at stake and why these issues are the way they are, or why we're making the case that we're making. You know, we don't do a good job in explaining the rules of impeachment or the rules of what the Senate is supposed to do in terms of their responsibilities towards impeachment of a president of the United States, even what constitutes an impeachment. You know, it should be made clear every day. Remember, what is impeachable is this, right? When a president asks for personal favors or things for his personal gain. I mean, all of these little small points in terms of the Democratic Party making their case towards defeating Donald Trump are being missed. And so, conversely, what we do is we jump on the social points that we think are trendy. Like, for example, when he makes the idiotic statement about, you know, early on in the campaign trail, you know, the statement that he made on a bus with Billy Bush about grabbing women by the crotch. So Democrats jump on that as a statement. And as messed up as it is, you can't really talk about the other party when you have individuals in your party who, you know, they don't have the most clean records in terms of in regards to how they treat women. I mean, it's not a unfortunately, it's not a Republican or Democratic thing. It's a dude thing. So you're going to have dudes in both areas. But to jump on that issue and make that the issue we're going to ride out and try to get this guy with is, like I said, it's you know, it's misguided. It's not knowing which plays to call or how to approach it. And these are the opportunities that I think that the Democratic Party, in my assessment, misses when we're fighting against this guy who is – you know, he's unfit, and like people say, he lies and has broken the law and broken these rules. And just, you know, when you get down to common sense, plain old country folk common sense, like people like to say, plain old common sense, it really is there's no question as to what, you know, Donald Trump has done during his time as trying to be president of the United States. And, you know, a lot of you guys know in the beginning, I would say often that I didn't think he was a racist because of some of the interactions that I perceived him to have with black people and some of the relationships that I perceived him to have with black people. But, you know, when you know something systematically hurts a particular group and you still condone that behavior by an individual or another group, then, you know, you are pretty much against the group that behavior is hurting. You're pretty much making it plain. So there's no real kind of, for me, no real kind of a gray area. Either you are condoning his racist statements, which incite people to do racist and hateful acts towards other people, or you don't condone it. And saying you like his fiscal policies and all that, that's fine. Which is kind of funny because Barack Obama is the one to turn the economy around. This is another thing that the Democrats constantly, they just miss out on. You know, the narrative now is that Trump's turned the economy around and the economy is good news for him, bum, bum, bum. Who do you think started that? Who started the economy turning around? It wasn't the last Republican president, that's for sure. So who had to deal with and clean up the mess and start that economy? And now, after the 8 years or the 6 years that was slowly picking up steam, now the economy is running. Now this dude is getting the credit after giving a tax cut to rich billionaires, $1 trillion or some crazy tax cut that he gave. Somehow he's getting credited with the economy running good now. Come on. Democrats, this is what I'm saying. How can that possibly be? How can that possibly be? But, hey, this is the opportunities that we constantly miss. And if it is possible, I mean, that he has done this miraculous job with the economy, is it, I don't know, did he make it run better? It was running out of the coming out of being the worst economy for however many years to running better to slowly picking up steam. Not enough, but it was not negative. And this guy comes along and he builds upon something that was already going great and wants to take credit for it. So, and we want to give him credit for it. It's just, you know, the media needs to really, the mainstream media, as they like to call it, you know, needs to do a little bit better job, at least the guys who are trying to their best to tell the truth. And I understand trying to get the information out there first and scoop people and be the first one. But, you know, deeper questions need to be asked. And also, too, to be quite honest, we need to have a more intelligent electorate. People need to educate themselves a lot more about the process of being a citizen, about the process of voting, and how the government works and it affects you. And this really would lead – that's what a lot of people don't want. And I think that's what the Republicans bank on, that people don't do, that they don't get educated to the facts and how the government works and how money is supposed to be spent and things like that. And I guess you have to be brought up in kind of that environment where that's a priority, or that's something that your people naturally pay attention to. And, you know, brought up in the environment that I was brought up in, and around people that are involved in the civil rights era during that time in American history, to be honest, there was no, really wasn't a choice. At the time of that these people were young in their mid-20s, mid to late 20s, people of my father's age and my uncle's age and a great many other people in Jersey and across the country that were getting involved in the civil rights era movement at the time that Dr. King was coming of age, they decided to make a stand in terms of where the progression of our people was going to go as African Americans and also as Americans, whether, you know, we're going to continue on the path that we were and that we still seem to be on to a large degree. And so there was no choice. My point is there's no choice not to be aware of the issues that affect you and affect your freedom. You know, there was no, there's the theme song keeps wanting to play, but there was no choice of not being aware of those things. So growing up in that era and being born at the time I was born, we just had to fight and had to be aware that what the things that were affecting our community. And okay, I didn't think the clock was going. Sorry, everybody. But anyway, so that's why we grew up aware and cognizant of the facts. And so, when you're aware of that, you're probably more aware of how the government works and history and things like that. You're going to be more in tune to what people, your representatives are, who they might be, who's out there fighting for you, because you have to. I often kind of chuckle to myself when I hear, I've heard the old kind of a phrase about don't discuss politics at home with family members or keep the peace with family. To me, that always seemed to be a thing that was foreign to me, because discussing the politics and at least amongst, I think, a lot of African-American black households, the politics were pretty much in line. Most of you, you could probably say 90% of total population of black people probably had similar political views, you know, fight back against the oppression that and the hell that we were getting in modern-day America. So I don't think that politics in a lot of African-American households, that discussion coming up during the holidays was going to be one that was going to cause a blow-up at a family gathering as much as the larger, you know, general majority population would promote in, you know, popular life and social life and things like that. I think, you know, in white families probably during that time it was you get the kids who are more liberal and hanging with black people and get the old school, you know, parents who are prejudiced or racist and they're not able to make those changes. Certainly that's a fact that has gone on in America for years. So I think that was probably the one of the political issues that was probably discussed back in the day that would cause family blow-ups at family gatherings. And certainly when you do your history and look at the turbulent time of the 60s, as a lot of people know it to be, historians, and things like Chicago, and I forget what year it was at the Democratic Convention, where there were riots and the police were, you know, kind of abusing some of the protesters. You know, certainly that's something that you can, is a perfect example of the tide changing from generation to generation to perhaps a more conservative, almost oppressive perspective, or supremacist, white male supremacist perspective, to a more liberal, diverse perspective, progressive. And certainly now, even that, during my lifetime, during, you know, the last 20, 25 years of my life, that concept, that notion has progressed. Now you are, a lot more white people are aware of American history from African-American perspective, or otherwise known as African-American history, but it's American history. And a lot more white people are aware of even the phrase white supremacy and its effects on our society, and certainly on black people, but on our society as a whole. And, you know, a lot more people are educating themselves and seeing the effects that are liberal or progressive people to begin with. And also, too, you know, it's nothing new in the world, and certainly in this country, to say, or to obviously for there to be a fact that there are white people that have always been progressive, or just, you know, about everybody should be treated equally. You know, all people are created equal. And even during slavery times, even though some of the people might have been in the minority, or, you know, there were people who believed that, abolitionists, and people who've always fought to make sure that all people had equal rights and were treated as a child of God. So, you know, but you the understanding is the point I'm trying to make, the understanding of the nuances, and the intricacies of racism, and how it affects people that have been oppressed, and black people, is impressive to me when I hear some white authority figures in, you know, social science and politics and things like that, people who talk about those issues, when I hear their understanding of that issue, of the issues and the dilemma that African Americans have faced in this country, there's an astuteness and a learned perspective that, as I said, didn't seem to be popular 25, 30 years ago, certainly during the time that my mother was on the radio, WLIB radio. You know, you have people like Tim Rice, and there's, I forget this white woman's name, who also lectures on racism and white supremacy and things like that, and its effects. And so back in those days that I'm referring to, those type of individuals are very few and far between, as far as I knew. And even to historians, you know, who included or were interested enough in black history. I knew of one gentleman, Bill Katz, who was a historian of African-American history, a white gentleman. And he wrote a book, Black Indians. He wrote a number of black history books, particularly on black cowboys in the Black West, that my mom became interested in, and would interview him several times on WLIB radio, and as we've done here on the Kay Thompson Live Show over the last couple of years. And unfortunately, he's passed away within the last month or two. But if you can get any books by the historian Bill Katz, I would certainly suggest that you pick them up, because highly recommended on my mom's top list of historian books. He's got some good information there that he shares with people, and his research and things like that. So I would suggest checking them out. I've got copies here that my mom had, my own copies, and he really reports on some good stuff. So, you know, this is where we are in 2019. Who would think that after the election of the first African-American president, twice, two times, that's really impressive. Impressive for any president to get reelected, but, you know, first African-American president, that we were so diverse, we'd come so far, and it was like a backlash. You know, I was just watching Susan Rice be interviewed on Chris Matthews, and she discusses that in her book, that there was a backlash of seemed to be a backlash against black people in an image that Obama presented, and our country in an image that was more progressive and diverse, and the election of Donald Trump and people who that he appealed to his base was an indication that there was a backlash against that, what she was saying. And there was she felt that it was Obama's race, but it was broader than that. I personally think she was being kind. I think it was minimally broader than that, but I think his race, being a black man, African American, and black family in the White House, is a little bit too much for a lot of people who are Americans. And when they got the chance, because if you, Donald Trump was the most extreme case, you know, I mean, if it's a rejection of a certain path that America is on, certainly he is the example of people supporting a totally different path, a path that the country was once on and they want to take it back to. And the choice there is, you know, it's unfortunate, and like I said, but he was the most extreme example. You know, there were other individuals on that stage who were conservative individuals who were also examples, I felt, of some of the extreme stuff that Trump represented, or certainly other candidates up there that appealed to some of the same base members of the Republican Party that he's appealed to. But that base and what he was saying, the more he said what he was saying, they chose him, the most extreme version of the rejection of everything that a Barack Obama represented for them. They chose Donald Trump, who was the pretty much the opposite, right? And if you just look at just even his the vibe to me, personally to me, of his kind of his public image. His actions, his public image. I mean, well, his public image is going to be affected by his actions, because he seems to be an angry individual, someone who always has to, you know, always has to get the last word in, and he's got to respond if somebody says something negative about him, and it doesn't realize that, yeah, you're the most powerful dude, so you don't need to flex that, you know. And so that seems to be his image, just unfortunately for him, I would guess, just to be a kind of just an unhappy, just an angry, you know, they said the white dudes, you know, that was a demographic, I suppose, people were referring to angry white men. And Trump seems to speak to that crowd. And what is even more surprising to me is that there seems to be, in certain individuals, no sense of fair play. I guess when you think that when you're a racist or you're a supremacist, you think that people are beneath you, then they don't warrant fair play, or they don't deserve. I don't understand the protestations and the declarations of being law and order people, and you're breaking the law just because it's not your preference. So the hypocrisy is startling when you think about the candidacy. There we go again. When you think about the candidacy and the candidate and now the president, but also it's also more startling when you think about the people that support him, because, you know, his actions, certainly the tax cut that he gave to the wealthiest, it's already been proven that they have hurt people in the middle class, haven't helped people in the middle class. And so many of these working class white folks are in that social economic demographic category. And his actions aren't helping them. So it doesn't seem that they're voting their personal interests. So they're voting for, I guess, a notion, an idea that never really is going to touch them. And that's unfortunate, because I've said it before and I'll say it again. It seems like people are voting. I'm going to say their hatred, but I also want to say that their negative impulses. their worst things that they think as opposed to their most positive impulses. And surely if you listen to Trump speak, he doesn't speak with, you know, doesn't speak with positive intentions, you know. Mike Tyson coined the phrase, you know, Mike Tyson being interviewed one time talked about boxing and said go with bad intentions. That's what the legendary trainer Cuz D'Amato taught him. Bad intentions. Throw these punches with bad intentions. And I would say Donald Trump is a public servant with bad intentions. You know, if you get on his bad side or just doesn't like something, he's got bad intentions. And I don't think that when you're supposed to be the arbitrator for everybody, the boss of everybody, so you're supposed to be the one, I guess when you're thinking you're the boss of everybody, then that just means whatever you say goes. But, you know, you're supposed to be the one to try to bring everybody together and calm everybody down, not hype everybody up and make everybody hate each other and draw a line within your own country. And what he's been willing to risk for his own personal means has really been surprising, and even more surprising that there are individuals that support and are willing to go along with and condone and not only and conspire in those attempts. So it's really kind of unfortunate for some of these individuals. Certainly, you know, with the impeachment articles and Mitch McConnell coming out and saying that he was going to do everything or work in accordance with the White House, is, you know, that's like I've been saying all along, that it's like a race. Can he put his people in place before the righteous people can reveal the stuff that he's been doing? And it's clear, you know, the way he's had the revolving door within his staff at the White House and other things, that's been the attempt to put enough people that are going to be loyal to him rather than the United States. And, you know, if you've been paying attention the last couple of days and heard about these couple of senators, Murkowski and Collins, expressing their concern about what Mitch McConnell said, that's a little bit encouraging. You know, you don't want to put too much stock in it, but, you know, like I said, there's that gray area in politics where, you know, you don't people have the opportunity to do things that serve themselves more than the people that send them there. So you never know. But I think the notion that, and this might go against the whole political structure, but it's really more, I think, an American kind of bipartisan thing, is that the notion that Democrats should support a Republican who's moderate in a red district, right? So if there's no possibility of a Democrat even challenging and obtaining and winning that seat, then of course the Democrats would do well to support the Republican that is closest to the center or the Democratic principles, right? A moderate Republican or something like that. So in the instance that you have here, when you have a Murkowski or a Susan Collins and they're talking about, you know, doing the right thing or having concerns about the Senate trial for impeachment, then it might do certain Democrats in their districts might have to consider, you know, is this, and I'm sure they probably already do. I'm sure, you know, I'm not saying anything that strategy that hasn't been thought out. It's just one that perhaps needs to be a little bit more talked about and spread. The notion of it needs to be spread to larger populations of the country so more people understand that particular strategy, that supporting you know, a moderate Republican, and obviously I'm sure that, I guess in certain circumstances, clearly, I'm sorry, what am I talking about? Right here in New Jersey, the state that I'm in currently, you know, the Republicans have done that. They supported a Democrat in South Jersey who was more close to their thinking and their ideology, and as a result now he's changing parties, even though he got elected off of the backs of Democrats. So, you know, when you have those things, I mean, the Congressman Leonard Lance, I don't know if that is his district, was District 2, I don't believe it was, but sometimes he was known to vote with the Democrats, and when he was in the Assembly in New Jersey sometimes, I believe he might have even been a Democrat at one time. And the same thing with someone like Bloomberg, and of course you've had people switch parties back and forth. But certainly it makes sense, good political sense, and I think just good, not only pragmatic, but, you know, civic sense civilian responsibility, I guess is the phrase that I'm trying to make up. It makes sense to do that, you know, when you have an individual that's close to your values and agrees with a lot of the morals that you agree with, then it certainly is worth supporting them. I think that's how a lot of things have moved forward in the country when you had bipartisan support, Democrats and Republicans coming together. You know, the notion that, you know, and this is something that I don't think a lot of people understand in politics and maybe need to understand it more, certainly from, I'll say, from our Democratic perspective, is that, you know, that whole old school notion of new presidents getting their honeymoon period, you know, with both houses of Congress for the first time, trying to work together for the betterment of the country. You know, of course, that was thrown out when Barack Obama got elected, and Mitch McConnell and a number of other Republicans decided that they were going to do everything they could to make him a one-term president and to work very little or as little as possible with him. And so that was kind of done with, and probably was done with a little bit with Bill Clinton, but certainly with Obama. And they've continued to do that ever since. And the bending of the rules of what they did with Obama's Supreme Court nominees, what Mitch McConnell did there, and clearly what he's willing to do now again in this particular instance with Donald Trump is evidence that, you know, these guys, if they don't like the rules, you can change them. And I guess if you're the rule maker, I guess there's that gray area that says you can make up your own rules. And it's very interesting how those loopholes pop up in certain individuals if they know enough about how the government works and the rules that our government is based on, I guess the Constitution, which apparently some of these guys aren't even interested in going by, you know. You know, you have to get people to agree to go by the rules. You're talking about a law and order society. I always say, you know, the honor system, going by honor system don't make no sense if some of the folks don't got no honor. You know, what are you going to do? And it's like there needs to be recourse that the parties have to do that. What are you going to do if this guy doesn't comply? Obviously, you know, everybody's supposed to comply with a subpoena, right? Everybody's supposed to comply with a subpoena, but they just decided not to. We ain't going to do it. Does that begin anarchy? Is that the beginning of a lawless society when you have a president who is just not going to follow the laws of the nation that he has been elected to lead based upon law? It makes no sense when you think about it, you know. And if you really think about it, you think how ridiculous it is, and you think probably would come to the conclusion that he's not the right guy for this job, because it should become obvious that he is more willing to serve his needs than the needs of the many, thus obviously the needs, i.e. the needs of the country. So you got to do what makes sense and what comes accordingly. Hopefully there's going to be some moves made where Trump's issues can be rejected, and the Democrats can focus on come up with one candidate or a team that can get the job done. You know, a lot of stuff been going on this year in terms of entertainment. One of the biggest stories to me has been Tyler Perry, his TV studio opening up, big huge rollout and stuff like that. And you know, I was talking earlier and kind of my thoughts, I've probably shared my thoughts with the work of Tyler Perry before, and the whole notion of when a lot of these plays that were known affectionately or not affectionately as or nicknamed the Chitlin' Circuit, the Shelley Garrets, the Beauty Shops, all of those type of plays that would go on a tour, kind of like the old barnstorming days, I guess, as some companies used to do, sports teams and theatrical black companies, traveling entertainment companies. But what these plays would do, they go on the tour of a lot of black cities, primarily, with large black populations, and they play in, I wouldn't say in the hood, but in the traditional old big theater houses, big concert hall houses, the Fox Theaters that they have, I guess, one in Detroit and Atlanta, and big Symphony Hall here in Newark and New York, Beacon Theater, and other places across the United States. And this would be, these shows are tours for primarily, and shows made to cater and to address and to entertain African American audiences for the most part. And what happened was, at the same time, August Wilson was obviously a reigning African American playwright and legitimate theater, American theater, Tony Awards, Broadway, and all that, while his plays and other playwrights on that level would have plays running. Once they stop running on Broadway, they go into kind of regional theater circuit, where regional theaters can perform. They might go on a national tour, some of the shows first, and then, you know, a year or two later, I don't know how exactly those details work, but the regional theaters within areas in Chicago and maybe Boston and San Diego that have these regional theaters, they would perform versions of these plays, of August Wilson plays and other playwrights. And normally what would happen, from my experience, I did a number of them before I moved to California, normally what would happen is that these plays would play at, like I said, a legit theater, a union-sanctioned house, right? And it would be part of a season. You know, these theaters, they have a season of plays, maybe five plays throughout a seven-month time span or whatever, and they would run for a month and a half each or whatever. So these theaters, you know, normally kind of more white established structures, theaters, and they would have, you know, for Black History Month, they might have a ethnic play or two, and so what would happen is that in a lot of these communities that might have large populations of African Americans, they wouldn't get the luxury to hear and see an August Wilson piece, because this theater might not do the necessary promotion and PR to reach out in particular to that community, because they have their own PR in place. They have subscribers, and they send out the mailings with what's the new season of plays are going to be, and people decide which plays they want to go to. And if you don't know about that theater and you don't know about what's going on and the activities there, and you're not going to be aware of that August Wilson and Two Trains Running or The Piano Lesson or Fences is coming to town as an African-American in that area. But what happens with the plays on the Chitlin circuit, they're putting commercials on the local black radio station, and they're running ads in the little newspaper or whatever. And so what happens is that the majority of the black population ends up going to see these plays as opposed to and becoming familiar with this type of work as opposed to becoming familiar with the characters of August Wilson. They are familiar with Madea, right? So what happens is that this is how these plays were able to do very well financially at the box office, because some of the ticket prices they were charging were the same amount of money that you might get at the legit theater, but they were just normally the concert halls were a lot bigger. You know, you might have 1,500 seats as opposed to 700, or maybe 1,000 being the most, the very most at regional theater, I would say. Maybe there's more, but I wouldn't say a lot more than that. But these other places, 1,500, 2,500, maybe 3,000. And so, you know, the math works. If they sell a certain number of tickets during the 3 or 4 days they're there, a minimal amount, and 1 or 2 nights have a great amount, then they're making money. And so that's how a lot of these people became, you know, the playwright, the guy who wrote Beauty Shop and things like that was one of the first ones, became a millionaire, multimillionaire. And I think that's where Tyler Perry, being the smart guy that he is, he also put himself in playing the Madea character, making himself the Tyler Perry symbol, icon, or logo for Tyler Perry Production, Tyler Perry Studios. Madea is the logo, right, for Tyler Perry Productions. Was initially, obviously changing now as he transitions to other things, but Madea is pretty much it. So him playing Madea made himself the commodity. Just like Oprah doing the Oprah show. You can't do an Oprah type show without having Oprah. Because Oprah, you know, Spike Lee. You can't do a Spike Lee movie, Spike Lee Presents, without Spike Lee. So you brand yourself, obviously. No, that's what everybody does now. They're branding themselves. But Tyler got hit. Branded himself as the character Badia, played it in a way that only he could play it, became so endearing and made so much money and soared so much with black audiences across the country that it blew up, did several, eventually did movies and thus, you know, so forth. And you know, as we all know, the rest is history, as they say. But that success story of that guy to now having a TV studio, being kind of pretty much one of the main sources for content for BET, and also, you know, also contributing for Oprah, to Oprah as well. I mean, I'm sure it's a matter of time before he has his own network, a short matter of time. But, I mean, that to me this year is like one of the biggest stories. And also what I was going to say, the real point about watching these things is that people who have studied and gone to acting schools and universities and you know, I think initially had a tendency to look down on the Chitlin Circuit plays, you know, the more serious actors, so to speak. And the type of content, you know, a lot of people were giving Tyler Perry flack initially for the Madea character. And I was one of those people that was kind of, you know, not too up on it, not feeling it too positive, hadn't seen any of the work. And I happened to be someplace, and I saw someone had a video cassette that they tape at the plays, and they sell the cassettes of the version of the stage version of the play. It's called a play. You don't have to call it a stage play. I hate that when people say that. Anyway, I got sidetracked a little bit, but it's just a pet peeve. So back to Mr. Tyler, that I forgot the point that I was, oh, the Madea character. I wasn't too happy, but happened to be in the store waiting for something, and they had this playing on a TV screen there. And I was just watching. It was one where Madea was talking to a little girl who was a bad little girl or getting in trouble or something like that. And, you know, the lessons he was trying to teach was a very old school parental or lessons that of morality and doing the right thing that parents and certainly black parents and elders try to give their kids and have been giving their kids forever. And in seeing that, I kind of really changed up. I got a little bit more political in my judgment about his art, his production of art, is that say what you want, but what he was trying to do was to bring some positivity to the type of project that he did, some type of positivity to the art that he was presenting for a majority black audience, for his people. And so I changed up, and also I thought Madea was really funny. Then when I saw one of the movies, I thought he was, you know, he's pretty hilarious as that character. And it was always this positive thing, and certainly when I saw him have one of his films where he had Cicely Tyson and Maya Angelou in the film together, on screen together, you know, things like that that this guy does to give respect and tribute and homage to those that have come before him are to be commended. And that's part of the reason why I personally, you know, like a lot of the work that he does. Some of the stuff I like more than others, but certainly someone who has a social responsibility, not to mention all the philanthropy that he does, that he's done, and things like that have helped his community. But certainly someone like that, an artist like that, is someone who, you know, should be supported. Listen, when he talked about having sound stages at his first studio named after people like Sidney Poitier, Whoopi Goldberg, and Cicely Tyson, that's an honor for people, for our people that you know, they haven't been recognized for their contributions, certainly for what they meant to us and our community, so very special. So, you know, to me, Tyler Perry, you know, he's kind of winning this year in 2019. But my man that really came towards the end of the year is winning, and I think he's going to be winning next year again, is Mr. There's his theme song. It's almost time to go, y'all, but it's Mr. Eddie Murphy, my man, the Murph, with Dolomite. I don't know if you guys saw Dolomite, but if you didn't, you need to check it out. And certainly if you kind of grew up in that era of the 70s and kind of reminds you of some of that old stuff and just the culture, the fashion, the language, the slang, you know, you'll love it. And the performance by Ed is is right on, you know, and he's nominated for a Golden Globe. He should get nominated for an Oscar, you know. The mark of the great comedians is that they're also really good dramatic actors. And there's a lot of times you could see that in Ed's work. Whenever you see these guys portraying a character that is comedic, but they're acting in such a, I mean, their acting is so good as this character. I mean, that's good acting work. And if you look at some things that Richard Pryor has done, certainly you can see that he had the chops to be a pretty, really good dramatic actor. Check out Blue Collar if you don't believe me. But the Dolemite story, as I heard, as I got up on a minute and a half for you guys, I heard the Dolemite story recited to me by my brother, who was of that age. He was, you know, in his 20s, I would suppose, during those days. And he told me and my cousins about the little Dolemite riff that, you know, people would often do when they hear their favorite comedian and they go recite the comedian's bits. And so that was the first time we heard about Dolemite. So I expect Eddie Murphy to really get some one of these awards anyway. So, but anyway, it's coming to the end of the time. This is the last show of the year. I don't know. I guess Brother Wayne and Brother Byron are getting prepared to have a really great time this evening and celebrate the incoming 2020, which we hope will be a much better year, we pray. That'll be a better year, and those that have gone before, we hope that pray that they're looking down and helping us. I'm going to be doing another episode of another TV show called New Amsterdam. I'll let everybody know. Thanks for the people who supported me watching FBI. I'm going to get out. You're listening to the Kay Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I'm the son, Citizen Payne, and my mom, like I said, is upstairs on assignment. She's got a lot of more people with her helping her out. My Aunt Catherine is a new arrival in the Heavenly Gates. And you guys, be safe out there. God bless. Blog Talk Radio, Kay Thompson Live. Talk to you again in the new year, everybody.